Mark Your Territory, Brian Sargent, Series Editor Bob Hastings. Chapter 1. What is territory? Size doesn't matter when it comes to territories. Imagine you are sitting next to a stranger at a movie theater. There is one armrest between the two of you. Whose armrest is it? Do you claim the whole thing? Do you give it to your neighbor? Do you try to share? Or does your elbow fight a small war with the stranger's? Territories can be small, like the armrest between two chairs, or they can be far larger, the size of a country or even a planet. Each territory brings the same question. Whose is it? Sometimes the answer is not very simple. For example, look at the land around the Sabine River in eastern Texas, USA. Before Europeans came to North America, it was the territory of the Tawakoni Indians. In the mid-1800s, the Tawakoni were forced to leave by European settlers, and the land was turned into farms. In 1960, the owners changed again. The state of Texas claimed the land and turned it into a state park. The river was dammed, and the land was flooded to make Lake Tawakoni. But even Texas could not keep all of the land. They lost some of it in 2007 to spiders. One morning, workers at the park found a giant web. It was bigger than two soccer fields. Thousands of spiders had claimed the area as their territory. People came from all over the country to see the amazing web. Several times the web was destroyed by bad weather, but again and again the spiders rebuilt it. What territories do you claim? Do you own a house or an apartment? Maybe it's a desk in a classroom where you always sit. Or maybe it's a garden with a fence around it to keep animals out. Think about your territory. Is it yours? Would you fight to keep it? Would you even fight spiders? Chapter 2. Turf. How do you mark your turf? If you wish to own land in California today, you'll need a lot of money. If you wish to own land there in 1849, you only needed 4 stakes. The year 1849 was the beginning of the California Gold Rush. That was when news of Californian gold traveled around the world. Nearly 100,000 people hurried to the area hoping to get rich. If you were one of them, you needed to bring 4 wooden stakes. At the time, land in California was free. Miners claimed their territory by placing 4 stakes in the ground at the corners. This was called staking a claim. It meant the territory and all the gold in that territory belonged to the person who staked it. The phrase stake a claim is still used today. If you stake a claim, you identify something as belonging to you. In the beginning, there were few laws about land claims. People could make small or large claims, or even stake a claim to many different areas at once. There were even people who came in later and took over other miners' claims. These people were called claim jumpers and were disliked by nearly everyone. It's easy to see why claim jumpers would be disliked, but who were the real claim jumpers? Before Europeans came to the area, California belonged to Native Americans. Over 50 different tribes lived in that area. When gold was found there, miners came and took the lands away from the Native Americans. Many tribes were forced to move to camps far away from their original land. The word turf means grass, but it is also another name for territory. Throughout history, people have had different ways to mark their turf. They may place a fence around their house or yard. They may draw a line on a map or place a flag in the ground. They may place a name on a parking space or office door. These markers identify their turf. When people mark their turf, they expect others to respect it, but this does not always happen. During the gold rush, people often argued over claims, especially claims with large amounts of gold. Sometimes these arguments turned violent. Arguments over larger territories, such as countries, can turn into wars. Even claiming small turfs can be the start of a bigger fight. Turf wars can happen over almost anything, even ice cream. Like most places in the world, in New York City, ice cream is a summertime favorite. Ice cream trucks sometimes drive around parts of the city, but more often they simply stay in one place and sell ice cream to the neighborhood children and adults. Ice cream truck drivers are very serious about their turf, and they don't like to share. Stories of drivers getting into fights or damaging each other's trucks are common. New trucks that enter another driver's turf can have their windows broken or tires cut. In one case, a new driver told the police that another driver had pointed a gun at him. Of course, the reason for ice cream truck turf wars is money. Sharing turf means sharing money. In a New York summer, that may mean losing over $1,000 per day. Chapter 3. Borders. Watch a show in Canada while sitting in the USA. The Haskell Free Library and Opera House is the pride of Stansted, Quebec, Canada. The Haskell Free Library and Opera House is also the pride of Derby Line, Vermont, USA. Finished in 1904, the building was built on top of the border that separates the two towns and the two countries. Most of the seats of the Opera House are in the USA. The stage is in Canada. Theatergoers sit in one country and watch a show in another. For the library, the entrance is in the USA, but the books are in Canada. A black line across the floor shows visitors when they've stepped from one country to the other. The location of the Haskell Free Library and Opera House was not a mistake. It was designed to be used by both countries. From above, the towns of Stansted and Derby Line look like one town. They share many things, including water and emergency services. Each town has a number of roads that begin in one country and end in the other. For years, residents of both towns traveled back and forth freely. In recent years, however, the USA has wanted to make the U.S.-Canada border more secure. They sent more border guards to the area and closed the streets that ran between the two countries. It is now impossible to travel freely between the two towns. Despite this, the library and opera house remain open, though it isn't as easy for residents of both countries to use them. Borders can tell a story. They can show a world that used to be, or a world that someone hopes will come. Look at the map of Carter Lake, Iowa, USA. Does it look unusual to you? Often borders follow rivers or other bodies of water. In this case, the border between the states of Iowa and Nebraska followed the Missouri River. In 1877, the river changed its course, leaving behind a town that did not know if it belonged to Iowa or Nebraska. The decision wasn't made until 15 years later, when the U.S. Supreme Court decided the town of Carter Lake was still in Iowa. Both Nebraska and Iowa wanted the town of Carter Lake, but what happens to a place that nobody wants? That is the story of Bir Tawil, Sudan. Or is it Bir Tawil, Egypt? Look at the red line on this map. In 1899, that was the border between Egypt and Sudan. However, just 3 years later, a new border was drawn. That is shown by the blue line. The difference between the two borders created two separate areas, Bir Tawil and the Halaib Triangle. It also created a problem. Both Egypt and Sudan claim the Halaib Triangle. Egypt wants to use the border of 1899, which gives them the Halaib Triangle. Sudan prefers the 1902 border. Left out is the small area of Bir Tawil. It's not inside of either country's preferred border. As a result, it's one of the few areas of the world that no country claims. Chapter 4. Common Ground. Most of the world's territory is claimed. What about territory in outer space? On July 20, 1969, two Americans walked on the moon. They were the first people to ever visit the moon, and before they left it, they placed an American flag there. What does that flag mean? Does it mean the USA visited? Does it mean the USA owns the moon? If the USA doesn't own it, who does? The answer is no one owns the moon. The 1967 Outer Space Treaty, signed by 101 countries, says no country can claim land on the moon. However, the treaty is not very clear about some things. For example, it does not set rules about resources found on the moon. If someone finds gold on the moon and wants to mine it, there are no rules for this. Perhaps someday, like California, the moon will have a gold rush. Will astronauts stake a claim with four wooden stakes? Does it sound unlikely that spaceships full of miners may someday travel to outer space? Right now, more than one company has a plan to do just that. They aren't traveling to the moon, though. They want to mine asteroids. Thousands of asteroids pass near Earth every year, and scientists believe those asteroids could be very valuable. Asteroids contain minerals such as nickel, cobalt, and even platinum. A 1 kilometer-wide asteroid could hold hundreds of billions of dollars worth of these minerals. To mine an asteroid, you must take everything you need with you into space: equipment, people, food, and water. In addition, your spaceship needs enough room in it to bring the valuable minerals back to Earth. The plan would cost billions of dollars, but it may make billions more. The Outer Space Treaty covers the moon, asteroids, and everything else in outer space. It says that these areas can only be used for peaceful purposes. There's another territory far closer that is covered by a similar treaty. Sitting at the bottom of the world, Antarctica is protected by the 1961 Antarctic Treaty. The treaty has been signed by 46 countries. It states that Antarctica will be a place of peace and science. It also directs countries to protect the special environment of Antarctica. There are many countries with bases in Antarctica. All of these countries have signed the Antarctic Treaty and promised to protect the environment there. However, there is a difference between signing a treaty and following the treaty, especially when following the treaty is expensive. For years, trash and waste were left outside Antarctic bases. By the year 2000, nearly 1,000 tons of trash, waste, and old equipment had collected on the land near Bellingshausen Station, the Russian base. Other bases had similar problems. Australia's Casey Station collected nearly 4,000 tons of waste. Countries were clearly not following the treaty. Fortunately, many countries, including Russia and Australia, have now begun cleaning up around their bases. It's an expensive job. The trash must be collected and taken away from Antarctica by ship. The cost for Russia's cleanup will be many millions of U.S. dollars. New Zealand's Scott base spends $10,000 every year to bring trash and waste back to New Zealand. Environmental cleanup shows the difficulties with international treaties. Countries do not always follow the treaties they sign. For now, though, countries are working harder to follow the Antarctic Treaty. Chapter 5. Squatting. From living with the dead to owning your own country, squatting is a way of life. Cairo, Egypt is one of the most crowded cities in the world. People will do almost anything to find a place to live. Some even share their home with the dead. Outside of Cairo is El Arafah, or the City of the Dead. It is a giant cemetery filled with tombs, some over 1,000 years old. And for hundreds of years, living people have made the tombs their home as well. Nobody knows how many people live in Cairo's City of the Dead. It could be as many as 5 million. Some live in their own family tombs, sleeping and eating in rooms in which they will be buried. Others have taken over tombs of other families, sometimes earning money as caretakers of the tomb. Life in the City of the Dead isn't easy. There is very little electricity or running water. Many of the tombs are falling apart. The residents are very poor people who would find it difficult to leave or buy a home outside the cemetery. Some families have lived in the tombs for generations. Most of the people living in El Arafah are squatters. Squatters are people who live on land that they do not own. Though squatting is against the law in most areas, it is very common. Squatters choose an area of empty, unused land or an abandoned building. In one famous case, over 2,000 squatters took over the Grand Hotel in Beira, Mozambique, a hotel once called the Pride of Africa. Not all squatters are poor. At least one is a prince. During World War II, the British built a number of sea forts in the waters to the east of the United Kingdom. These small forts had large guns to protect parts of the UK from German airplanes. After the war, the forts were mostly forgotten. In 1967, Roy Bates, a 46-year-old former member of the British Army, took over one of these forts and declared it to be a new country. He called it Sealand, and he was its prince, His Royal Highness Prince Roy of Sealand. The day was his wife's birthday, and he declared her Princess Joan. Not long afterward, a group of men tried to take over Sealand. Bates used guns and bombs to stop them. Nobody was killed, but the next year Bates was brought to a British court for owning and firing a gun. The court, however, decided that Sealand was not part of the UK, and Bates was free to go. To Bates, the UK had just formally recognized the country of Sealand. In 1977, while Bates was away, a group of Germans took over Sealand. Bates returned in a helicopter and recaptured the fort. He sent all but one of the men home, forcing a German diplomat to come and ask Bates to free the man. Bates agreed and declared that now Germany had also recognized his country. Prince Roy died in 2012. Sealand is now ruled by his son, Prince Michael, though the international community still does not recognize the small fort as a country. Chapter 6. What would you do? Could you be the next Prince Roy? Sealand has its own money, government, and passports. It is also for sale. Not the whole country, just small parts of it. For around $31, you can buy 0.1 square meters of Sealand. If that is not enough, for $310, you can become a count or countess of Sealand. But why stop there? If Prince Roy could make his own country, why not you? There are no set rules for how to make a country of your own, but a 1933 treaty suggests the following. 1. You must have a territory. 2. You must have a permanent population. This means someone must always be living in your country. 3. You must have relations with other countries. 4. You must have a government. The first three are the hardest. Besides Bir Tawil, there are few unclaimed territories in the world. Possibly none. If you do find one, you must have enough people living there that someone is always in your territory. It is possible to live in a country all by yourself, but if you ever leave for any reason, then your population has left too. As for relations with other countries, you cannot control what other countries do. Perhaps the easiest part is making your own government. If you created your own country, what laws would you write? Would you keep any laws of the country you live in now, or would you change everything? Would your country have a president or a king? What would you call your new country? Think about your answers and then take out a map. Maybe you'll get lucky.